Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife extra episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. In this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Nicholas Rouleau, PhD, about his essay, An Immortal Stream of Consciousness, the Scientific Evidence for the Survival of Consciousness After Permanent Bodily Death. And this essay was a Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies essay competition winner. Hi, Nicholas. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about an essay you wrote for the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies.
Yeah, that's right.
And the title of the essay is An Immortal Stream of Consciousness, the Scientific Evidence for the Survival of Consciousness After Permanent Bodily Death. To begin with, how did it come about that you wrote this essay?
It's always difficult to know where to begin with these stories, but a close friend and colleague of mine told me about this competition, and I thought it was a great opportunity to get some thoughts out that I had been sort of digesting for years, having worked in the laboratory of Dr. Michael Persinger, who was a clinical neuropsychologist who sadly passed away in 2018. But when he was alive and when he was working on some interesting ideas in the field of neuroscience, he was pursuing all these great ideas around, what is the paranormal really? What are psi phenomena? How are these related to physical forces and quantifiable, measurable phenomena in the world that we can go out and actually report on and really predict and control? And so I had been thinking about these questions for years because I was his graduate student. I was his last PhD student. And for my PhD, I had actually written about the postmortem brain and its functional capacities. And that's really, I think when certain people will hear that, they'll think, well, what can the brain really do if it's already dead? And that's exactly the question I was trying to answer during my PhD was, is there a material property to the brain itself that allows it to have functional capacities after the cells have actually died? And so having worked on that during my PhD and having been alerted to the existence of this competition, I thought, what a great opportunity to sit down and actually write out what I think about the continuation of consciousness after death.
So the subtitle there is The Scientific Evidence for the Survival of Consciousness. Do you think there is enough evidence to show that it is real, that consciousness does survive?
I don't know that we have evidence that consciousness survives bodily death. I think what we have is really what we have for really any scientific question, which is we have evidence pointing in a certain direction. And I think that we can make a scientific case for the existence of consciousness after bodily death if you are following certain kinds of assumptions about how brains function. And that's the main argument that I put forward in the essay, which is if the brain functions in a certain way, which is to say, if it functions in a productive manner, and that means that cells and tissues are actually generating consciousness, and this is the standard neurobiological view of how consciousness either emerges or is produced. If you think that that's the case, then it should be the case that consciousness does not continue after death. But if there's a totally different way by which brains function, which is to say that they function by transmission, then consciousness could continue after death. And really, I frame this whole question around that sub-question, which is really about characterizing how the brain works. If the brain works in this transmissive way, if there's anything about the brain that suggests that it can transmit information, that it can actually pick up information from its environment directly, not through the senses, but rather as a direct transduction at the level of the brain itself, then there is a possibility that consciousness actually continues after bodily death.
So you said there are assumptions there about the brain. Is what you're saying is that the scientists, some scientists assume the brain works in this way or parts of the brain work in this way, but it's just an assumption. There's no proof that it actually does work that way.
I think that it's important to think about how science is done and separate several parts of how science is performed, at least in the sort of modern context. So you typically what you have is a hypothesis, and you test that hypothesis, you measure something, and then you can actually interpret your measurements. And once you interpret those measurements, you sort of narrativize the phenomenon and then put that out into the world. And then others can check your work by repeating those experiments and interpreting their results and so on. And this continues just forever. The critical feature there is the interpretation. And so you may have an experiment that's performed and the results come out, and two people look at the same results and come to totally different conclusions based upon the framework that they're adopting for interpreting those results. So for example, if you measure the brain and you're stimulating the brain in some way, what you'll find is that you'll see responses on the neuroimaging data. So if you're using an fMRI or an EEG to measure brain activity in some way, you'll see responses. And those responses can be viewed as having come after the stimulus that was applied to the brain. And we will make conclusions based upon a whole bunch of assumptions that we haven't really outlined explicitly, such as, causes always precede effects. You know, there is a physical world. You know, there's all sorts of philosophical assumptions that go into our interpretation of the actual results. And these are just taken for granted in most contexts. But I think that the current neurobiological explanation for consciousness, which is to say that when people are reporting experiential phenomena, we see that their brains are doing certain things. Like, we see, for example, neurocorrelates like gamma oscillations or perfusion of blood to certain areas of the brain that are associated with people reporting certain kinds of experiences. When we see that, we say of those neural correlates that, in fact, the brain is producing consciousness. They're not just associated. They're not just correlated, but rather we make the leap and say, no, actually, we think that these neural correlates are, in some sense, mechanistically producing the conscious event. And that's basically where we are with neuroscience and the neuroscience of consciousness right now, which is to say that there's a whole bunch of brain stuff happening, and that brain stuff is responsible for the experience. But in many cases, what we really have is correlational data. We have brain events occurring simultaneously with experiential phenomena, often before the experiential phenomena, but some of them are happening simultaneously. And there's a certain interpretation of that data, which is convergent with a whole bunch of assumptions that are made in neuroscience. I think that in many cases, we can reinterpret a lot of those data in the context of other frameworks about the functional parameters of the brain. And we can get into details about all that, but I think that's really the critical issue here, is that we take for granted this certain model of how the brain works, but there are actual alternatives to how it could work. And I'll say that these models aren't all mutually exclusive. It's quite possible that the brain works in several different ways that are running in parallel. And some of those functional capacities explain certain phenomena, and some of those functional capacities explain other kinds of phenomena.
So would you say that science knows a hell of a lot about the brain? Or it's like, well, maybe we know 10% and there's so much more we need to learn?
I think we actually know quite a bit about the brain. You know, if we start with neuroanatomy, which is one of these topics that I'm passionate about, if we talk about neuroanatomy, I mean, if you look at old models of the brain from the 1800s, for example, you'll see that we've known about the neuroanatomy of the brain for a very long time. In fact, if you go back thousands of years to ancient Egyptian writings from physicians at the time who were examining patients and noticing their the behavioral correlates of certain kinds of brain injuries, you realize that we've known about brain anatomy for a very, very long time. You see these beautiful drawings from Renaissance artists about brain structure and so on. So we've known about brain anatomy for a very, very long time. Is there more to know? Sure. I mean, as we develop, you know, better imaging technologies, we can go deeper and deeper and look at, you know, higher resolution images of how individual neurons connect and so on. But the gross neuroanatomy has been known for a very long time. Even the histology at a kind of, you know, at the centimeter, millimeter scale, we've known that for a very, very long time. So we have an idea of how this thing is structured. We have an idea of which pathways connect to which areas. All of that is well-known and well-characterized. In terms of function, I would say that we also know quite a lot. For over 100 years, we've had very great models of how the brain functions. They're highly predictive, that are based upon ablation and stimulation studies. We know that if you damage certain areas of the brain, it produces certain kinds of reliable functional deficits. And those are highly repeatable, and they're highly conserved across peoples all over the world. We also know that if you stimulate those same areas, you don't see decrements of function, but you see enhancements of function, right? So we have a kind of independent verification that those areas of the brain are very closely tied to certain kinds of functions. And it's all very repeatable. It's all very predictable. And you can use it to control behavior, and you can use it to control cognition. We know enough about the brain to really control animal behavior, including human behavior, to a very precise measure. Is there more to know? Of course there is, because the brain is probably the most complicated object that we're aware of in the universe. And we're learning new things every day. I've read some authors describe the neuroscience literature as a torrent or a fire hose of information that's just constantly putting out new information every day, you know, in the primary literature. And that's true. But we know quite a lot about the brain. I really don't buy this idea that the brain is just this, you know, it's still just this black box that we don't understand. Of course, there are things we don't understand, and we may be getting a lot of it wrong vis-a-vis the types of assumptions that I was talking about a little bit earlier. But I think that we do know enough to make great predictions and to actually control animal behavior quite well.
Well, I was talking to somebody else on the podcast a few weeks ago, and they were talking about something, I think it's called hydrocephalus, where it seems like a massive amount of liquid builds up in the skull, and the brain is pushed up against the interior of the skull, and maybe only 2 or 3 millimeters thick, but the person still functions perfectly normally. Does this kind of thing make sense to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as long as, so the brain is quite, so its material properties are very interesting. It's viscoelastic. It can be contorted into various shapes as long as it's hydrated. As long as the inputs and outputs are maintained, as long as there's a certain kind of structural integrity that allows for afferent and efferent signals to make their way across the brain and to and from the periphery, you can expect those functional correlates, behavior and cognition, to be quite normal, or at least within normal range. Now, what you'll also find with these kinds of patients that have hydrocephalus, and when their brains are squished out to the perimeters of their skulls, if they incur even a small brain injury, an injury that for you or I would not produce a major functional deficit, for these individuals, they would produce very profound functional deficits. The brain in that state is quite susceptible to being damaged. But as long as the function, as long as the structural and functional integrity is maintained, it can be contorted into many shapes. There are people who live among us who have cysts and enlarged ventricles who don't notice any functional deficits for very long periods of time because, yes, their brains may be contorted into different kinds of shapes, but all of the functional pathways are maintained. And so as long as those pathways are maintained, you can expect function to proceed as usual.
So it sounds like the brain is a really robust thing. It's not just the slightest little thing is going to throw it off. It can neuroplasticity, that the brain can rewire itself.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a lifelong phenomenon. I mean, you see a lot more plasticity in when we're embryos and perinatally. But the brain is indeed very robust. We lose a massive amount of brain cells in our earliest years of life. So you can see like a tenfold reduction in these brain cells. And yet we become wiser and smarter and more learned over time. And that's because it's really not about the number of cells. It's more so about connections and refining those connections. And you'll find also that, you know, it's just some interesting facts that I think put into perspective the robustness of this organ. You lose about 86,000 of these neurons every day. You're losing about one every second. But because you have tens of billions of them in the cerebrum, you don't notice it until very, very much later in life. So once you get into your later 70s and 80s, then the effects of aging start to become evident. So we're talking about, you know, around 10% of your brain mass being lost. Then we start to see really pronounced functional decrements. But before then, people are losing cells every day and the brain maintains its functional integrity. You actually get better at things that you practice because of this incredible functional plasticity.
So in the essay, you say that near-death experiences may not be the best scientific evidence for the survival of consciousness. But there are a lot of veridical NDEs, aren't there, that seem very hard to argue against.
I think that's right. And I don't mean at all to say that that evidence should be thrown out altogether. I just don't think that it's very compelling for, you know, many people for bad reasons, but also for some good reasons, which is that it's very difficult to verify. So experiential evidence will always be outside of the realm of direct scientific investigation, in the same way that consciousness research, you know, suffers from the same problem. When people report subjective experiences, they're personal. They can't be independently verified. But if they match something that's happening in the environment, if you actually have an objective referent in the environment, then they can be quite powerful. You know, for example, some of the data showing people identifying objects in the room that they couldn't have been aware of unless they had a totally different vantage point, and they claim that their soul or their mind came off of their body, and they were able to actually see these things in the environment, and then, you know, they report them after the fact. I think that's really interesting, and that needs to be investigated, needs to be thoroughly documented. There's other phenomena like mediumship that I just don't think meet the same. It doesn't meet the same kind of standard for empirical measurement. I want to be able to measure something. I want multiple observers to be able to point to the same thing and agree on what they're pointing to. And so there's certain kinds of evidence that meet that criteria, and there's others that don't. But aside from all of this, I don't think any of that is the best evidence for the continuation of consciousness. I really do think that the best evidence for the continuation of consciousness after bodily death really comes down to whether the brain functions one way or another. And I think that if it does function in a transmissive capacity, then that opens the possibility to consciousness continuing after death.
So could you explain the transmissive theory to us then, please?
Yeah, sure. So this is William James's idea, and he put this forward as an alternative to brain function in what was at the time the canonical understood way that brains functioned. And interestingly, it's the same way that we understand brain function to proceed today. So at the time, in the late 1800s, William James, he contrasted various types of function, really highlighting two kinds that he thought it would be important to compare. So the first was productive function. And productive function is how we think the brain works right now, which is that there's some mechanism that actually produces the function. There's some objects that when they interact with each other are producing experience. And that is the neurobiological model of consciousness. We think that, you know, if I put on my neurobiologist hat, I would say that, you know, consciousness is produced by neurons generating a certain kind of causal structure of signaling in the brain that involves the cerebral cortex and the thalamus and circuits between these areas. And that is where consciousness comes from. When the brain dies, those circuits no longer exist. And so consciousness can no longer exist. So that's the productive model. And the transmissive model is a little bit different. When you're thinking about transmissive function, rather than thinking about, you know, a mechanism that generates something directly, you can think of filters or sieves or, you know, certain kinds of instruments. So William James brings up two, I think, salient examples that really illustrate this. The first is the prism. So when you shine white light through a prism, the light is broken down into a spectrum of color. And you cannot say that the prism is producing the color. The color doesn't come from the prism. What the prism is doing is it's splitting the white light into its constituent wavelengths. It's splitting that white light into, it's filtering it in a sense, into the different wavelengths that the white light is actually made up of. The other example that he points to is the pipe organ. So if you think about how pipe organs work, air runs through the various cavities of the organ. And the way that it moves through the organ and is sifted by the organ produces certain kinds of sound. And that sound can't be said to have come from the organ itself in a productive sense. It was transmitted by the organ. It was filtered by the organ. The air, before it became pressure waves that we perceive as sound, was actually just air in the room, molecules bumping into each other in no directed fashion. But once it moved through the pipe organ, it became patterned. And those patterned waves, then when we interact with them, we experience sound and we experience music. And so if we think about how the brain might function in that way, you could think of the brain as this organ that exists in a world full of physical forces, and perhaps it interacts with forces in the environment such that the cells themselves are not producing this function, consciousness, experience, but rather they're picking up some signal in the environment or transforming it or transducing it in such a way that that signal exists independently of the brain in some sense until it interacts with the brain and then becomes something else, in the same way that air is just, you know, this sort of inert, unpatterned thing until it moves through the pipe organ and becomes music.
In the essay, you say the brain is fundamentally an electromagnetic organ. So that's something that can be influenced by outside electromagnetic forces, can't it?
Yeah, that's right. So in my view, and this wasn't William James's argument, is I building on his argument that the brain could be a transmissive organ, I point to the very large and very convincing literature around brain electromagnetic interactions and how the brain is quite susceptible to patterned electromagnetic fields, time-varying electromagnetic fields. Either artificial ones or natural ones produced by the planet, and how the brain is effectively an electromagnetic organ in the sense that, you know, even the canonical signaling pathways that are involved with brain function, like the action potential and aphaptic coupling and electrotonic signaling, these are all electromagnetic phenomena. Yes, there are chemicals involved, of course, but even those chemical dynamics can be reduced to electromagnetic phenomena. The brain is this incredible electromagnetic organ. Not only is it receptive to electromagnetic fields, and we can talk about all the evidence for that, but it also produces electromagnetic fields. The electric component of that is picked up as neural oscillations. And we measure that as EEG, electroencephalography. And now we're also measuring the magnetic components. So the brain is also emitting magnetic fields. We measure that using magnetoencephalography, or MEG, using superconductors placed around the brain. And we also now, it's important to realize that light is the carrier of the electromagnetic force. And so, you know, it may be relevant to ask, does the brain emit light? And we just demonstrated earlier this year that the brain does emit photons. It emits light, and those photons are patterned in such a way that you can measure them and you can correlate them with certain kinds of brain activity and cognitive states. And we're calling this photoencephalography, but it's been known for quite some time that tissues of all kinds, including the brain, emit photons. And so, yes, the brain is an electromagnetic organ. It's susceptible to electromagnetic fields, and it emits electromagnetic fields and light.
So there's a thing, isn't there, where the tests have been done of putting artificial electromagnetic fields on the brain, and the person says that their whole emotions change, or they get a sense of a presence in the room, or they get scared of something.
Yeah, that's right. So when I was in grad school, I was working under Dr. Michael Persinger. In his lab, he studied these phenomena, like how the brain interacted with electromagnetic fields and what kind of experiential phenomena people reported when they were exposed to electromagnetic fields. And he'll be best known for his work with what was called in the media the God helmet. He called it the Corrin helmet, but it's basically solenoids that emit electromagnetic fields over the temporal lobes. And when you expose people to electromagnetic fields over the temporal lobes in the microtesla range, that's the intensity of the field, which is about a million times weaker than an MRI, people do have really interesting experiences. They have what's referred to as the sensed presence. They feel like someone's in the room with them. Often that sensed presence is attributed to either a deceased loved one or to a deity or a god. Usually if it's indeed a deceased loved one, that person is known to the individual who's being exposed to the electromagnetic field. So it's someone in their personal history. If it's a deity or a god, it's typically the label that the person uses to describe the being in the room with them is consistent with their cultural background. So if they're a Christian or a Catholic, they'll refer to God, or if they're a Muslim, they'll say it's Allah. If they're a Hindu, they'll say it's Vishnu or Brahma. The labels are culturally contextualized, but the phenomenon is conserved across all these individuals. And we know from other studies that if you expose people to electromagnetic fields, the pattern really does matter. And if you, there are certain kinds of patterns that can produce alterations in mood, alterations in state anxiety, in different kinds of experiences like fear, and they can also modulate pain as well. So we know that the brain is receptive to these electromagnetic fields.
So where would consciousness be if it's not generated by the brain? Is it some kind of electromagnetic field that's all around us, all around the planet?
Yeah, so that was, Dr. Persinger thought that it could exist in the Earth's electromagnetic field. So he presented several calculations which demonstrated that all of the information from all the human brains on the planet could be stored in Earth's magnetic field. You might ask, well, what does Earth's magnetic field have anything to do with the brain? We've known for a very long time that brains cohere with oscillations of Earth's magnetic field. So the Earth generates this massive... So it generates this magnetic field because there's molten metal in our core, and it's rotating. And so we have this magnetic field, and it protects us from solar radiation, from coronal mass ejections. When you see the aurora borealis, what you're seeing there are particles from the sun sort of dancing in Earth's electromagnetic field, being funneled towards the poles. And that's a beautiful visual display of Earth's magnetic field. But there's all sorts of things that are happening that are not apparent visually. When we have magnetic storms caused by coronal mass ejections from the sun, birds
like homing pigeons, for example, can no longer navigate because they use Earth's magnetic field to navigate in 3D space. Cows will orient in different directions in fields. Dogs will orient in different directions. We have humans who, if they have a history of epilepsy, are more likely to have seizures during these periods of time. People are more likely to have heart attacks during these periods of time. So there are all sorts of phenomena that are happening that are associated with Earth's magnetic field. And we know that if you place a person in a Faraday cage, so this is an enclosure that blocks out external electromagnetic fields. If you put someone in one of these spaces and you measure their brain activity is quite different when they're in the Faraday cage relative to when they're outside of the Faraday cage. And it's not a non-specific difference either. It's associated with alpha waves, a specific kind of frequency of activity in the brain, and mostly within the posterior regions of the brain, which most leading theories of consciousness agree that there is an importance to the posterior regions of the brain for the generation of consciousness. We know that just putting someone in a Faraday cage and blocking out these electromagnetic fields actually changes people's, not only their brain activity, but their conscious experience. So there's all sorts of evidence pointing in the direction of electromagnetic fields in the environment being associated with consciousness. Is that where consciousness is stored? I think that's something that we have to examine in terms of the question at first. Like, you know, would we ask, is music stored in the air before it's sifted by the pipe organ? Probably not. I don't think that's something that we would agree is happening. What is happening is there is the existence of air, and that air can be patterned by the pipe organ. In the same way, there's an electromagnetic field around us, and when it interacts with the brain, we may get certain kinds of functions that emerge from that interaction. And that should be, you know, I think that actually coincides with a lot of different existing theories that have been around for a while. For example, the famous neurophysiologist John Eccles, who was one of the Nobel Prize winners with Hodgkin and Huxley for the discovery of the action potential, he hypothesized that there was actually a fundamental particle called the psychon that exists in the universe. And when it interacts with the brain, produces consciousness. So he actually viewed consciousness as a consequence of the brain as a material, its interaction with this particle that may exist. What I'm saying is that, you know, I'm saying in the essay that the electromagnetic field in the environment could serve as something like this psychon, where it's a physical force that exists in the world. When it interacts with the brain, it produces certain kinds of experiences and changes brain function in interesting ways. And that could be evidence for the continuation of consciousness after bodily death, because if some of that information associated with consciousness is stored in the environment or is around us outside of the brain, then when the brain dies, that information still exists in the same way that if you were to smash a radio, radio waves still exist in our environment. And if I were to build if I were to put that radio back together and turn it on, it would still pick up the signal that never really went away. It was always there in the environment. The brain, the in this analogy, the radio had been smashed and was no longer able to pick up the signal, but the signal persisted nevertheless.
So that rebuilding the radio analogy, could that be applied to a brain in some way? Could you get dead brain, and if you put in just the right amount of electricity, you get signs of consciousness? Sounds a bit Frankenstein.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I did for my PhD dissertation. I was very fortunate to have access to about a dozen human brain specimens in Michael Persinger's lab. And when I was introduced to this idea of transmissive consciousness, I asked the question, you know, what could brain material itself, devoid of biological function? So these cells are no longer alive. They've been preserved chemically through a process, but the structure is still maintained. If you look at the structures under a microscope, it looks exactly as it looks when it's alive. Could that brain tissue actually have some kind of interesting function such that when it interacts with electricity, patterned electricity, or when it interacts with electromagnetic fields, there's some change in terms of the output or how that signal is processed by the tissue itself that coincides with known brain signals that we see when the brain is alive. And what I found was that if you run certain patterns of electrical current through brain tissue, those patterns are amplified or suppressed differentially based upon the area of the brain that you're applying the current to. There are certain areas of the brain that amplify signals, and there are certain areas that don't do that. And those areas seem to be localized primarily within the temporal lobes. The parahippocampal gyrus seems to be an area that really amplifies these frequencies that are associated with conscious experiences and memory. And I thought that was really interesting. I think it coincides with some of the data associated with, you know, putting people in Faraday cages and looking at their brain activity and seeing how that changes. Yeah, I think that there's really, there's an interesting line of evidence here around postmortem brains and treating them as tissues that are material-like and that have material-like properties that are separate from their biological properties that we should pursue in the interest of finding these kinds of functions that could be transmissive and could explain how the brain responds to electromagnetic fields beyond, you know, simple induction or some biological mechanism involving magnetite or, you know, quantum mechanisms and so on.
Do you think that our consciousness depends on the Earth's magnetic field in some way? And that if the field changed fundamentally, we would?
Well, I think the second part of your question, I think the answer to that is yes. I think that if Earth's magnetic field were different in terms of its the way that it oscillates or its intensity, I think we would be different and biological systems on the planet in general would be different because there's all sorts of interesting evidence, not only around consciousness being influenced by electromagnetic fields, but also morphology. If you place organisms into either enclosures where they're exposed to electromagnetic fields or enclosures where the external electromagnetic field is blocked, embryonic development changes. Like the actual organism develops differently. And that's really interesting. So I think living systems functionally and structurally are a product of their environmental interactions. And one of those environmental interactions is Earth's magnetic field. Is consciousness dependent on Earth's electromagnetic field? Well, that's really, I think, a more difficult question to answer because we would actually have to remove humans from Earth's magnetic field. And electromagnetic fields, you know, unlike the sort of cartoon images that you might see in a textbook, they continue on forever. They go on and on and on and on, but they just, their intensity decreases as a function of the square of the distance. So, it's the influence is always there. It's just, it gets weaker and weaker. And I think there are tests that could be done in practice to actually assess this. I think that the Faraday cage experiments are a version of that kind of test where we're greatly decreasing the intensity of the electromagnetic field in the environment and then noticing how brain activity changes. I think that's part of the evidence for the dependency of the brain on external electromagnetic fields. But I actually argue in the essay, as well as in a follow-up paper about the same topic, that I think that the brain is both a productive and transmissive organ. I think it actually has two functional capacities, at least. And I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all. I think that the brain can produce action potentials and all of the neurobiological story that, you know, is in the canonical neuroscience literature. I think it can do all of that and still be a transmissive organ in the sense that, you know, it has certain functions that are dependent on external stimuli in the environment interacting with brain tissue. So if we removed the human being from Earth's magnetic field, I still think that there would be functions that would be preserved. I just think that experience might no longer be there, like subjective experience. And if it still was, I think those subjective experiences would be quite different. Yeah.
I wonder what that says for astronauts then, if they would go to Mars or something.
Yeah, it's a great question. And we'll soon find out, I assume. There are certain plans to do that. And I would be very interested in looking at brain activity in astronauts who are moving away from the Earth and seeing how those change as they move away. I mean, there are certain confounds that need to be addressed, like amount of time in space would be something that would be correlating with your distance from the planet, because if you're moving towards Mars, you know, time is elapsing, but also you're moving in space. So you have to control for certain things like that. But I think that if you had appropriate controls where you had someone in space for a very long period of time, let's say on like the International Space Station, and you had the same amount of time, but the person was traveling away from the planet, I think it would be really interesting to compare the brain activity between those two individuals.
So you mentioned something earlier about the body and the brain emitting photons, but there was something you mentioned in your essay about the death flash. What is that?
Well, we know if you have cells in a dish and you use some kind of chemical means by which you can actually have the cells either self-destruct or lyse, which is to say they sort of pull apart and die. If you do that to cells, they will emit photons. They will emit more photons than their baseline levels. And we know this is true of tissues. We know it's true of cells. And then after that initial flash, you get less and less photons over time until you get basically background levels. So the tissue dies not all at once, but gradually over time. And you have eventually an absence of a biological source of photons. Now, in the human, there are all sorts of reports of people seeing something come off the body around the time of death, or seeing an aura or a flash of light. And these kinds of experiential phenomena are really interesting. They're often not measured because they're very rare, and they happen in sort of sensitive contexts where people either don't want to be measured or aren't really thinking about that at the time, or they're settings where it's just not feasible to measure these phenomena, right? Like hospital rooms have fluorescent lighting, and that doesn't allow you to bring in special sensors to measure light coming off of the body. But people do report these experiences of flashes of light. And that is the beginning of a scientific question. You can actually, in practice, measure these things. We've measured them in animals, and you can see these bursts of light come off the brain upon death. And that seems to coincide with what you see electrophysiologically with the brain, too. If you put some probes in the brain and measure either the chemical release or electrical activity within the brain upon death, you do see this massive surge of activity around the time where the brain is dying. And then eventually things become quiet and less responsive over time. But you do see these interesting flash phenomena. I think that's fascinating. Most people would dismiss this and say, well, that's just, you know, people are seeing all sorts of things. But I think the first question to ask is, can people actually detect the level of photons that are coming off of the brain? And even though the photons that are coming off of the brain are extremely low in terms of numbers, we do know that single photons can be detected by the eye. There are some very interesting experiments that were done that show that people can detect individual light particles. They can detect the presence or absence of those individual light particles. And so all it takes is a few, you know, it takes one photon really, but if you have any more than one, you know, the likelihood that that's experienced in some way becomes greater and greater.
I wanted to ask you about children with past life memories. There seem to be a lot of children, and they might only be 4 or 5 years old, and they give a tremendous amount of detail of a previous life, and it's confirmed. So could this thing be that it is consciousness being reborn, or could it be something like there's a record kept in the electromagnetic field that the child is picking up on?
Yeah, this is an example of a phenomenon that's in the current paradigm would be just dismissed or ignored because it doesn't fit with the neurobiological model of consciousness. But regardless of what the mechanism is here, and I won't pretend to understand how this works, but just the fact that the experience exists and that it exists across several cultures and it exists over time suggests that something is happening here. But you know what it is that's happening, I'm not too sure. All I know is that this phenomenon that you're describing is perfectly sensible under a transmissive theory of consciousness, because if there is something like a consciousness signal or information related to brain states that's stored outside of the brain, then when individuals die, that information still persists in some way. Where it persists, it's difficult to say. And you know, it may be Earth's magnetic field, but it may be something else entirely that we're not aware of. But under a transmissive model of consciousness, it is quite possible that a brain that is similarly structured to another would receive the same information. This could also account for, you know, why it is that certain individuals who have similar brain structures, like twins, have similar thoughts or have the experience of sharing thoughts. Under the neurobiological model of consciousness, you might say, "Well, look, they share a genome, and so their brains are patterned in the same way." And so, of course, you know, given a certain deterministic model of how brain functions should proceed, of course they're going to have similar experiences because their brains are structured in the same way. And if they're siblings and they were raised together, they have the same experience as well. So nature plus nurture being, you know, completely equal between the two, or at least as equal as you can get, of course you're going to assume that they're going to be able to have shared experiences, or two private experiences that overlap almost entirely. But I think you can reinterpret those same data in the context of a transmissive model where you say, well, look, it would be like having two tuning forks in the same room responding to the same pressure wave in the environment. If I hold a tuning fork on one side of the room and you hold a tuning fork on the other side of the room, and they have the same kind of spatial dimensions, that is, like the two forks are, you know, they have the same separation between them, even though they're separated by, you know, the distance of the room, if you have the same pressure wave in the room, they're both going to oscillate together. And they're going to oscillate because they're responding to the same stimulus in the environment. In the same way, you could have a consciousness signal in the environment, and you could have two brains separated in space or time that are responding to the same stimulus. Now, how that mechanism actually works in practice, that's something that we don't have the answers to. But a transmissive model as such does account for those kinds of experiences.
So does this transmissive theory imply that consciousness could exist without life, like before life on Earth?
Yeah, I'll sort of call us back to the analogy with the pipe organ. It would be like asking, did music exist before the pipe organ? Because, of course, air was around before the pipe organ. You know, the pipe organ may even be made of wood, which was generated, which is made of the trees that generated the oxygen that is producing the sound and so on. I think that, yeah, you can, you could hypothesize that the signals that exist outside of the brain that account for some subset of brain function will have existed before the brain was ever produced by an organism, was ever self-organized by living systems in the world under selective pressures. You could absolutely have a consciousness signal that exists outside of the brain before a brain even comes into existence.
You also have in your essay suggestions for experiments that detect consciousness. What are these experiments?
So as you know, the field of consciousness is fraught with all sorts of problems. And some of those problems involve really drawing causal conclusions from correlative data. And one of the main things that we do right now in consciousness research is measure brain correlates. And then we point to those correlates and we see how they systematically change as a function of the person's experience. I'm proposing basically the exact same type of framework, but instead of looking for the correlates at the level of the brain, we look for them in the environment. So if there are signals in the environment that, when we measure them, correlate very strongly with either behaviors or cognitive states, then we can point to those as correlates that are really, in the same explanatory dimension as neural correlates. They are physical events that we can point to that are very strongly associated with experience. And I think that we can even go one step further, and we can see if those signals in the environment are patterned in the same way that neural correlates are. At the level of the brain, if we look at the brain as an electromagnetic organ and we're looking at electric fields at the surface of the scalp, this is electroencephalography. These are what brain waves are. We notice that there's all sorts of certain frequencies that are tied to experience. So gamma waves, for example, are a certain kind of neural oscillation that we know is tied to conscious waking experience. And that would be oscillations within, the frequency range of 30 plus hertz. So 30 cycles per second or more. If we can find a signal like that in the environment that is systematically changing with people's experience, then we can point to that signal as potentially being associated with transmissive function. One way to do this, I don't know if I mentioned this in the essay, but it just occurred to me that, if you have large populations of people who are sleeping and large populations of people who are waking at a given time, half the planet is going to be in the dark and half the planet's going to be in the light. And we're animals that rise and rest with the light in the environment. I think it'd be interesting to look at signals in the environment that predict whether humans and other organisms are in a sleeping state versus a conscious state that coincide with neural oscillations that we know are also predictive of whether someone is in a waking state or a sleeping state or a dreaming state indeed. So I think that there are ways to actually test this. It's not like this is an untestable phenomenon. There are indeed ways to make this an empirical project. We just have to have the will to do it. And there needs to be a certain kind of open-mindedness to the idea that there may be signals outside the brain that influence or even cause conscious states.
What is the best evidence for the survival of human consciousness?
I really think that, I'm going to sound a bit like a broken record, but I really do think it comes down to whether the brain works as a transmissive organ or not. If the brain is productive, if the brain is just cells shuffling ions across membranes and releasing chemicals that stimulate their neighbors, and you have this internal system that is entirely explained, its functional causal power is entirely explained by the objects within the system itself, I think that consciousness cannot survive bodily death. So anything that demonstrates that is not a fully explanatory model of the brain
opens up the possibility that there are other ways that consciousness might be coming into being. So if you can actually demonstrate that there's all these functions of the human organism, cognitively or behaviorally, that cannot be explained simply by, you know, all these parts interacting within the system itself, in isolation from an external environment, I think that does open up the possibility that there is an explanation for consciousness that doesn't entirely reside within the head. In order for consciousness to survive, it needs to exist in some sense outside of the brain. If it exists in the brain, simply as, you know, energetic dynamics at the level of neurons or chemical shuffling or some electrical transduction, if that's where it exists, then when the brain dies, and when those cells are no longer able to produce those functions, and when the structures of the brain begin to decay and decompose, consciousness won't survive. It is entirely dependent and bound to those structures. But if it exists in some sense outside of the head, and we can detect it in the environment outside of the brain, then the possibility of it existing after the brain has died suddenly becomes, you know, something that could exist. It's possible. It's something that we can pursue and maybe even rescue, maybe even retrieve. It could be possible that if consciousness exists outside of the brain, yes, your brain will die someday. But if we create a system that allows for that information to be captured or reintegrated with machines or with some other substrate that isn't biological, that isn't subject to all the entropy of a biological system that's constantly putting itself back together, it's possible that consciousness could not only exist after death, but actually be re-expressed or reconstituted after death.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
The essay is An Immortal Stream of Consciousness. And if people want to read it, can they find it online?
Yes, you can find a free PDF copy just by Googling the title of the essay. It's hosted by the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies. And because I realized at some point that there really are people who want to read exclusively using certain formats like Kindle, I've actually put the essay on Amazon as a Kindle, as a sort of Kindle product or as a paperback, and people can access it there as well. So you can either get it as a free PDF or you can get it as a Kindle.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
And that was an interview with Dr. Nicholas Rouleau, PhD, about his essay, An Immortal Stream of Consciousness, the Scientific Evidence for the Survival of Consciousness After Permanent Bodily Death. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And don't forget, my book is out there, Verified Near-Death Experience, it's titled. It's sold over 2,000 copies. Has had over 55 star reviews, and you can get it on Amazon on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.